This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Resource Center and I'm Maya Tan. Now, the culture of an organization can empower companies in today's business world. However, while a culture that supports strategic and operational goals can fuel performance and spur innovation, a culture that opposes the company's strategy could lead to calamitous results. So today's questions would be, what kind of company culture do you have and what kind of culture should you have? My guest today is a published author and veteran consultant, best known for his work on the informal organization. He's been linked to McKinsey & Company, was head of leading management consulting firm Katzenbach Partners. He's now senior executive advisor at Strategy and over the course of his career has counseled high-profile CEOs and corporate leaders. He's also written a number of books, including the bestseller The Wisdom of Teams. Please welcome John Katzenbach.
Thank you, Maya.
Mr. Katzenbach, how would you define organizational culture?
First of all, I would describe it in simplistic terms. It is the combination of mindsets, beliefs, and habits that determines how people do what they do. It's a determinant of behavior. It is more emotional than it is rational. And I think we've been paying increasing attention to it in recent years because the emotional side of behavior can either help you or hinder you, and particularly when things go tough. You want emotions supporting what you're trying to do. So that's the way I think about it.
And you're a veteran, so you've seen it all, you know, big corporate cultures, small informal company cultures. What do you observe of current organizational trends?
I think you use the term correctly. The term cultures, plural, is more important than we might think. So I don't know of any organization of any kind that is not multicultural. And that's important to keep in mind. So the multicultural nature of organizations today presents a real challenge.
Okay.
I could oversimplify, but I think it would be useful at the beginning. If I were to think about the winning companies I've seen over the last 40 years, what would separate the leaders from the also-rans? The winners, what separates them? And the most notable thing is that they get a lot of help from their culture. And I use the term cultural situation rather than culture because it is multicultural. Be that as it may, the best performers over time are going to get a lot of help from their cultural situation. And the help they get that the rest of us sometimes underestimate is emotional. That's what a culture represents that the rest of an organizational approach doesn't offer, as nearly as I can tell. The culture provides reservoirs of emotional energy, and you want to take advantage of those. So that's why, it's strategy, operations, and culture are the three things that need to be aligned. And culture is the most emotional and challenging of those three.
Right. How does a company develop its culture? Is it just a matter of people hiring people who are like them, and therefore you have this one unified culture? But as you say, it's also multicultural, and that's where sometimes challenges arise.
Yeah, I think when you start small, a small organization, you can shape your culture. The larger you get, the less influence you can have on it. So what you start with is a function of who you hire, and you tend to hire people like yourselves. And that's the basis, that's the core. And as that increases in size, it introduces people of different persuasions. And so it becomes more and more difficult to change. And I think one of the things organizations fail to realize is that once they're global, the chances of them changing their culture very much, very fast, are very, very small. You don't change a cultural situation that's global very much, very fast. And I think that's the main mistake that large companies make today. They think they can change a culture in the same way they can change an organization structure or they can change a strategic priority, mm-hmm. and they cannot change it that fast.
Right. Why would they want to change?
Because, as you said earlier, if you get cultural support, that's emotional energy. So you want to get emotional energy to get the most out of the human capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they see that slipping, they want to change the culture in order to make up for that.
Right. They want their employees to feel,
yes.
Feel, understand, and live the values of the company. And
yes.
then they would give their best, because if they're not happy at the workplace, then they just would be either just pushing the pen or they'll be leaving in about 6 months.
Well, I agree with some of what you said and not with some of what you said.
Okay.
Feeling is a key word.
Mm.
That's what it's about here. What kind of feeling? We want to get a positive feeling from our people. And it's not necessarily happy. Okay, so many high-performing organizations are comprised of people who aren't necessarily happy.
Okay.
But they are energized by what they do. So it's a subtle difference, but it's an important one.
Okay. You're an advocate of the informal organizational culture. Can you tell us why?
Because it allows you to tap into sources of emotional energy. The formal side of an organization is more rational, and that's the side that we're most experienced with. So we can shape a strategy analytically and logically. And if we have a winning strategy, we feel good about that. And we can design an organization. We can design the structure. We can design the programs. We can design the processes. Those are all designable things.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want to get our people energized, you have to affect the emotions. And that's going to help. That's going to come from your culture. And rather than change it, you should be trying to understand it because it's multicultural. And there are positive forces in any culture that can help you energize the human side of what your organization is trying to do.
Okay. Well, speaking about informal cultures, what do you think of the culture at organizations such as Facebook?
Well, first of all, the culture is not either formal or informal. It's both.
Okay.
But your question is good. What do I think about the cultures at Google, for example?
Mm.
I think they're a big advantage. I don't know Facebook as well as I know Google, but I'm sure the same is true. So it's that energy that is in the organization that is emotional. That's a big advantage for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big advantage. And they should pay attention to it so that it doesn't slip away from them, because it gives them an advantage in the behavior of their people that's hard to duplicate. I think it's part and parcel of why they succeed.
Just to backtrack a little bit,
sure.
You mentioned formal and informal. What are the differences?
Well, formal is something that you can design and you can work with through things that are tangible. So an organization structure
mm-hmm.
is formal. A set of organization processes are formal. They can be designed, and they are going to influence people with their logic and their controls. Informal goes around the formal side. It's what people do when no one else is watching, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Informal relationships are formed in any part of an organization.
True.
And those informal relationships have something to do with the formal side, but they also are more affected by personal relationships than they are necessarily by structures and processes.
And you're saying that both can actually exist
yes.
in an organization.
I think both have to exist in an organization.
Right.
They have to. The larger you get, the more you need formal process and controls.
Okay.
Okay. But if you ignore the informal side, which is interpersonal relationships and interactions, you will pay a price for that, because formal can't take care of all aspects of the what you want people to do for you
mm-hmm.
in the organization. So you do need both. When you're small, you can be largely informal. As you get larger, you need formal structure and process to help you. But you don't want that formal to snuff out the informal
mm-hmm.
because it is where the emotional energy comes from.
Right. Actually, what you're saying really resonates with me, because we're a small startup.
Yes, yes.
And in the beginning, there were a lot less processes. And my boss has always crossed that boundary.
Right.
You know, he's like, I'm not your boss. You know, it's a very horizontal kind of setup that we have here. But just recently, because we've kind of doubled in the last year in terms of teams, the processes are starting to come in.
Well, but see, when I came in, I can see the energy just by walking through. Right? People are energized and interacting informally. But the larger you get, you have to have some kind of way of bringing efficiency to the operation.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to be careful that you don't ever snuff out that informality. That's the danger.
Right.
And even in military organizations, the informal side is very important in terms of emotional commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get larger, as our management gets smarter, they want to prescribe too much. And by doing that, you snuff out the emotional, informal energy that is so important to the best performing organizations.
I guess that the thing to strive for is a balance between both.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I'm with John Katzenbach, author and senior executive advisor at Strategy And. We're talking about organizational culture. And in a moment, we're going to find out how to build a culture that sticks. This is Resource Center, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Resource Center, and I'm Maya Tan. John Katzenbach is here. He's the senior executive advisor from Strategy And. He's also an author and an expert on corporate culture. John, what happens when a company's culture goes against the grain of the company's goals?
It slows things down,
mm-hmm.
and it can actually destroy the organization. So when you start with a small organization, it's important to pay attention to the things that will allow the informal energy to continue. You shape a culture of an organization by focusing on what I call the critical few. What are the critical few behaviors that are most important in this organization? Is it collaboration? Is it customer relationships? What are the most important behaviors? You want to keep a close eye on those behaviors all the time. Then you want to pay attention to the sources of emotional energy that you're building. And if you watch the behavior and the sources of energy closely, you will be able to keep that in line with what you need to do strategically and operationally. But if you don't focus on the critical few, it can slip away from you before you realize it. And that's what happens when companies kind of lose the alignment, where their culture no longer is supporting emotionally the strategy and the operations priorities. When you lose that, it's hard to replace.
So these would be the things to consider when you're thinking about changing the culture in the company.
Actually, I advise large companies not to focus on changing the culture as much as they focus on using elements of the culture to change behaviors. It's more than a sort of a play on words, it really is. Changing cultural traits that are from multiple sources, deeply embedded emotions, very hard to do. But using sources of emotional energy to change critical behaviors is much easier. So if I were running any company, I'd be wanting to make use of what is in my culture as much as possible all the time. And I would be focusing on using that emotional energy on a few critical behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, it's pretty hard to lose that part of your culture that matters to you.
I saw a video of you on the Strategy And website, and you said that in the last 3 to 4 years, you've noticed that we're going about trying to change our culture in the wrong way. Do you have any case studies? You did mention, you know, what some of the common mistakes are that companies are making.
Right.
But have you got any case studies to share with us?
Well, I think the case study I would share with you is Southwest Airlines in the United States. And the reason I would share that with you is because it exemplifies the importance of the critical few. So when Southwest Airlines got started, it was a simple notion, and that was they were going to create an airline that had three terminals, San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. and they were going to start to bring three things into that picture that they felt would differentiate them. The first thing was they wanted every employee to concentrate on making every passenger feel good about the experience.
Okay.
So number one, make customers feel good, whatever you have to do. And if you can't make them feel good, at least explain to them why you did. So number one, make them feel good. Number two, we're only going to hire people that energize one another. We're not going to hire anybody that doesn't get energized by the people they work with. Number two. Number three was spend as little money as possible.
Okay.
Do everything on the cheap, if you will. I don't think they'd use that term. But now, that was, I don't know, 40 years ago. And they have driven down that path relentlessly over that period of time. They are now the number one or two airline in North America, both in size and profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an amazing accomplishment. They still focus on the same three things.
Okay.
Make sure you make every passenger experience as good as it can be. And if you can't make it good, at least explain it.
Okay.
Number two, don't hire anybody that the rest of us aren't going to get energized by and that doesn't like the people around here.
Mm.
And number three, don't spend money on anything. So what I know about Southwest Airlines came from research that was not funded. They never hired me as a consultant, okay?
Okay.
They don't spend money on anything, even consultants. And so those three things, the critical few, have produced a remarkable culture. In that organization, people, they have an attribute that I now look for whenever I'm trying to help companies get more out of their culture. And what they have is volunteerism. People in Southwest Airlines volunteer to work together in all kinds of ways to correct anything that they see that is creating bad customer feelings. And they have literally dozens of these groups of what I now call authentic informal leaders. Emphasis on the informal.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that earlier.
Right.
So the informal leader works outside the hierarchy, mm-hmm. works outside the process. The informal leader, simply by virtue of personal respect, influences people in a positive way. And they have been able to capture that. And so if I now go back and look at what I've learned from that example, it's very powerful. Number one, stay focused on a few things. Number two, make sure that you take advantage of people in your organization who cultivate the respect of those they work with.
Okay.
That's what their secret is.
You know, in HR, there are consultants who come in and say, okay, there are different personality traits and there are different types of employees and they have different behaviors in the workplace. So in order to have a complete team, a team that complements each other, you'd have to have one which is type A, one which is type B, one which is type C. Doesn't that just sort of confuse the culture then? Or is it also dangerous to have all apples, you know, thinking one way, doing things one way, and not caring about certain areas?
Yes, that's a good question. It's a very good question. And I think diversity is important.
Mm.
I think it is. So you don't want all apples. On the other hand, you don't want people who are uncomfortable working together because you're going to lose the informal side of your organization. So there's a mixture here.
Mm-hmm.
I would never want to see less diversity in terms of an organization. On the other hand, I would certainly want to see a concentration of constructive interaction. And I've spent done a lot of work internationally with teams of consultants and teams of client people. And diversity is always a plus. Sometimes you have to work a bit harder to get people to appreciate one another,
mm-hmm.
that haven't had the opportunity to understand the differences. But diversity should never be sacrificed in the interest of having people get along. I don't think that's necessary.
Right, okay. What about in Malaysia or Asia? You know, things tend to be a little bit more conservative as opposed to companies like Google. So what should we, from your observations, what should we be paying attention to in terms of creating healthy culture?
I would pay attention to essentially the same thing. First, I'd start and say, be granular about the traits in your culture. What does it consist of? And articulate those traits in neutral terms. Don't assume they're either positive or negative. They are simply aspects of the culture that are characteristic of Malaysia or this part of the world and characteristic in the company. You want to get granular about them so you understand how to pick and choose relative to the behaviors you need. And I would be using what you have, not walking away from it, definitely. Okay. I've seen the critical few notion work in the United States, in Germany, in Australia, in England, where the underlying national cultures are quite different. So I know that if you're articulate about what the culture consists of, you can pick and choose among the positive aspects of it and get that emotional side working on the behaviors that matter most. And I think that's true of any cultural situation.
Okay. You're working on a book, The Informal Advantage.
I'm always working on a book.
That's fabulous.
Always, yes.
So The Informal Advantage would cover how leading organizations can mobilize their informal organization to get performance advantages. Can you tell us more about it?
Well, the last book I wrote was Leading Outside the Lines, and it's about the informal organization. The first book I wrote was about teaming, okay? What I didn't realize when I wrote those books is both of those were scratching at the edge of culture. So now, in my declining years, I've decided to bring it together and try to talk about culture. And that's what the book is doing. It's basically what we're talking about. The title of the book is going to be something like The Critical Few. That's what it's going to be. Because I think that's what lets you take advantage of cultural situations that you cannot change.
Are there any questions that I'm not asking that I should be asking?
Well, I guess if I were you, I would ask, is it true that a traumatic event is the only way to change your culture? The reason that's a good question is that's conventional wisdom says, if I want to change a culture, the best time to do it is when something traumatic has happened. Example, the Malaysia Airlines lost plane, right? Or example, when General Motors was in bankruptcy. Or example, when the Aetna Health Company was approaching. So those are traumatic events. And the interesting thing about the traumatic event is it is a good time to influence your culture because people are up for change, right?
Right.
I don't think it's essential that you have a traumatic event to influence your culture.
Okay.
I think that opportunity can influence your culture. But again, I think you have to realize that a better word than culture change is culture evolution or shaping our culture. Because if we say culture change, we think that in 3 years we can have a new culture. My assumption would be you'll be lucky in 30 years if you have a new culture. But when you experience something that raises emotions, you can take advantage of that influence on aspects of your culture. And too many times we forget how to do that.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show. That was John Katzenbach, author and senior executive advisor at Strategy End. You've been listening to Resource Center with me, Maya Tan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.